Hello, folks. Thank you for tuning in to the Federalist Files. We're going to be going over the very last installment of the Federalist Papers, Federalist number 85. It is titled Concluding Remarks. It's written by Alexander Hamilton, August 13th, 1788. Topics include the exaltation of Republican form of government and a conclusion of the amendments themselves and how they would be implemented through the Constitution to show that there's this divide of powers. So yes, this is going to be the last one, folks. I greatly appreciate everybody tuning in. And this has been amazing, this journey that we've had for, you know, it's been over 6 months. I started this at the very end of October of 2020. We've pretty much gone through everything. We've gone through the election, continued with some current events. And this will conclude what I set out to do initially with this podcast, which a lot of people told me I wouldn't be able to do. I'd be unable to do it. I didn't have the time constraint. There's too many time constraints. You have a full-time job. How are you going to be able to do this? You know, you're not going to get anybody watching it, which, you know, viewership has been continuing to go up, which is pretty solid. And I have everyone here to thank for that because, once again, I don't really advertise much. So this is just word of mouth. That's how people find the podcast. Now, this specific part of the podcast, the Federalist Papers, are a little bit more specialized. You're not going to find people tune into this as much as some of the current events, which, once again, let me just address that I will continue with current events. We're going to be doing them Wednesday nights now. We're going to move it from Tuesday nights to Wednesday nights, and then Saturday night going into Sunday, we're going to be doing the weekend specials. So we're just going to do two podcasts a week. That's what we're going to go with from here on out until things change. If the podcast gets more successful over time, obviously I would cover more. But for time constraint reasons, it's good now, especially because my job's getting pretty hectic. A lot of volume, a lot of hours. So it's kind of good that I'm cutting back a little because these last, you know, 8 months have been pretty hectic for me. So to start this paper off here, and it's the concluding paper, Hamilton, he begins by informing readers that he will not go into discussion about the proposed government because he's already kind of hit everything in relation to some of these state constitutions and the topic of security and how it's going to be afforded to the Republican form of government. But he's going to talk about a couple other things. He's going to talk about specifically just the character of the Constitution, how great of a document it is. And then he's going to go over amendments, which hasn't really been addressed that much, which is pretty awesome. So he expresses that these topics have been thoroughly exhausted throughout the progress of the work, and to repeat the same forms wouldn't do them justice, which he's correct. Then Hamilton, he calls out some of his dissenters of the proposed Constitution in the state of New York because under that state government, under that state constitution, which they live, they admire so much, it's actually very similar to the proposed Constitution. So you had a bunch of objectors to the Constitution saying there's this wrong, this and that. But it was the same, almost the same system that was implemented in the New York state constitution itself. So Hamilton, he reiterates that there's additional securities provided by this Republican form of government that is beneficial to liberty, property, life, a new ability to crush factions, infighting, despotic leaders as the main source of this new security. So the biggest problem and the reason for the Constitution was to give more power to the federal government, implement a court system federally, which wasn't there before with the Congress assembled, they called it, during the Articles of Confederation. So they really laid out in this Constitution how to make a more energetic and powerful, a more robust government, a federal government. That was Alexander Hamilton's main concern, whereas with James Madison, it was much more about personal liberties and still being able to sustain those personal liberties while also having the additional security of the federal government. So he asserts, he states, and I quote Alexander Hamilton, "The additional securities to Republican government, to liberty, and to property to be derived from the adoption of the plan under consideration consist chiefly in the restraints which the preservation of the Union will impose on local factions and insurrections, and on the ambition of powerful individuals in single states who may acquire credit and influence enough from leaders and favorites to become the despots of the people. In the diminution of the opportunities to foreign intrigue, which the dissolution of the Confederacy would invite and facilitate, in the prevention of extensive military establishments, which could not fail to grow out of wars between the states in a disunited situation, in the express guarantee of a republican form of government in each, to each rather, in the absolute and universal exclusion of titles of nobility, and the precautions against the repetition of those practices on the part of the state governments, which have undermined the foundations of property and credit, have planted mutual distrust in the breasts of all classes of citizens, and have occasioned an almost universal prostration of morals. End quote. So yes, he lays out here what the main basis or all the problems that are now being solved by this federal constitution, the biggest one being factional violence because of Shay's rebellion that happened prior. They were worried about insurrections from specific groups, specific demographics, and we needed to implement this constitution to stop infighting with a state military from New Jersey and a state military from New York. We just establish a federal military and we allow for a militia, but they're not as organized as a federal head. They're called upon when needed. As well as this additionally gives a safeguard against state governments trying to usurp their power. And the protection from the federal government is supposed to be the state government in the current system that we have. I mean, we haven't really seen that much more in modern times. Everything's kind of ran federally, unfortunately. The federal government has become way more powerful than it ever was intentionally meant to be. Now, what's interesting is he goes through how amendments are to work and what the safeguard against these amendments are going to be. And I think that there was a kind of a universal regard for what the philosophy was behind using amendments. I think that the founders thought if you wanted to get anything done federally, you actually would have to go through with some sort of an amendment to add extra powers to the federal head. Whereas nowadays terms, we don't even talk about amendments to the Constitution because it's just, it would not be possible with half of the things that they're implementing right now. So Hamilton charges his dissenters with misrepresenting the proposed government as against the liberties of the people. He states, and I quote, "The unwarrantable concealments and misrepresentations which have been in various ways practiced to keep the truth from the public eye have been of the nature to demand the reprobation of all honest men." End quote. So yes, all the dissenters, all these misrepresentations of what the Constitution is to be and what it is, they deserve or they demand. There will be a nature for reprobation by all honest men, people that will just condemn it because it's so fallacious, their charges. So he goes on, he states, and I quote, "The charge of a conspiracy against the liberties of the people, which has been indiscriminately brought against the advocates of the plan, has something in it too wanton and too malignant, not to excite the indignation of every man who feels of in his own bosom a refutation of the calumny. The perpetual changes which have been rung upon the wealthy, the well-born, and the great have been such as to inspire the disgust of all sensible men, and the unwarrantable concealments and misrepresentations which have been in various ways practiced to keep the truth from the public eye have been of a nature to demand the reprobation of all honest men," as he said before. It is not impossible that these circumstances may have occasionally betrayed me into intemperances of expression which I did not intend. It is certain that I have frequently felt a struggle between sensibility and moderation, and if the former has in some instances prevailed, it must be my excuse that it has been neither often nor much." So yeah, he struggled himself to have these fights and try to do it in a cordial manner, try to be amiable about these, be much more of a temperate mood in his expressions, is what he's saying. But more importantly, is he's talking about, oh, there's this conspiracy. The dissenters are saying there's this conspiracy against, you know, the liberty of the people in the Constitution, which just isn't true. And he says these changes, he's talking about the wealthy, the well-born, the great, are the ones that are the ones that are pointing out the problem with the Constitution, because under the current system that they had, they were connected individuals. They were almost like oligarchy, like aristocratic people that they benefited the most from the Congress assembled, from the Articles of Confederation. It was people that wanted more power in the state governments because they saw themselves as almighty and all-powerful in these state governments with a federal head that is detrimental, and it could jeopardize their power that they have in their individual state governments. So next he goes on, he states, and I quote, concessions on the part of the friends of the plan that it has not a claim to absolute perfection have afforded matter of no small triumph to its enemies. He says, why, say they, should we adopt an imperfect thing, why not amend it and make it perfect before it is irrefragably established? End quote. This may be plausible enough, but it is only plausible. In the first place, I remark that the extent of these concessions has been greatly exaggerated. They have been stated as amounting to an admission of that the plan is radically defective, and that without material alterations and rights and the interests of the community cannot be safely confided to it. This, as far as I have understood the meaning of those who make the concessions, is an entire perversion of their sense. No advocate of the measure can be found who will not declare as his sentiment that the system, though it may not be perfect in every part, is upon the whole a good one, is the best that the present views and circumstances of the country will permit, and is such as one as promises every species of security which a reasonable people can desire. End quote. So yes, you have the objector saying this is an imperfect system because man has made it. And what his answer is there's an established way to amend it if there are alterations are possible. And the alterations actually are much more of the power for amendments. It's the power of the states to get together. Two-thirds of the state legislatures have to say, hey, we have this amendment that we want you guys to debate on a constitutional basis, right? And then they debate it on the House and the Senate floors. And then they go, they do their vote. If two-thirds agree, then it goes to the state legislators. State legislators, three-quarters of the country has to agree. And then it's an amendment that gets passed through to the Constitution. So there's ways to alter the system, but it's a fallacious argument to say this is an imperfect system because we said so. It has problems, but we don't really know yet what the problems are. We perceive in the future there's going to be some problems. He said if that's the case, you will never find a Constitution that you like. You guys just don't want the power of a federal head that would take away established power that you had in individual states. So Hamilton, he answers criticisms that the plan isn't perfect and should be reassembled with another convention to rectify this, is what the dissenters say. Now, Hamilton, he contends, he states, and I quote, the system, though it may not be perfect in every part, upon the whole is a good one. So that's what he said earlier. He continues, he states, and I quote, I never expect to see a perfect work from imperfect man. Now, Hamilton, he firmly believed that men of discernment would be able to make this decision with a sober dictates of judgment, the right decision of whether to approve the Constitution or not. Which is, he's correct about that. You don't need to leave it up to the oligarchy to do so. So he goes on, he states, and I quote, the moment an alteration is made in the present plan, it becomes, to the purpose of adoption, a new one, and must undergo a new decision of each state. To its complete establishment throughout the Union, it will therefore require the concurrence of 13 states. If, on the contrary, the Constitution proposed should once be ratified by all the states as it stands, alterations in it may at any time be affected by 9 states. Here, then, the chances are as 13-9 in favor of subsequent amendment rather than of the original adoption of an entire system. End quote. So what he's saying is for the adoption of the system, you need every single state involved in the system to agree with the adoption of the Constitution to take it up as the supreme law of the land, which is that's how that happened. You had 9 states that ratified the Constitution. So at that time, that was the Union, and then there was a couple other states that were outliers that eventually, over time, ended up ratifying the Constitution. I think the very first one is Delaware that did so. That's why, if you ever see a Delaware license plate, it always says something like the first state. But you had 9 states that originally did so, but if you wanted to accept the Constitution, you needed to ratify that Constitution. If you want to amend the Constitution, though, he says it only takes 9 out of the 13 if all of these states were a union, which pretty much means like 3/4, right? So the idea is that the Constitution can be modified with amendments requiring a 2/3 of a vote in both the House and the Senate, the bicameral cabinets of the legislative authority, to call a convention. And it will be validated and ratified by 3/4 of the state legislatures. Thus, the Constitution can be changed and compromised if need be. This is actually very important. He kind of goes into how I've been explaining some of these omnibus packages that we've seen from the legislature. He says, well, an amendment is only going to be on single issues. If we have amendments to the Constitution, we're going to do single issues because we all want to know who we get on the record and how they vote. So he's going to go on to actually explain that. And I think it's funny that this is an argument that's been held for a very long time, that if we're going to vote on amendments, we're going to vote on laws, it should just be single issue laws, or it should be only so many pages long. So we know the legislative authority, like we understand which members of the House of Representatives or which members of the Senate we should vote in or vote out and get rid of. It gives more accountability to them, to the people. Instead of doing these 2,700 page packages where if you go and you try to look on the news, you can't even find what the packages are about. And that's really the point, so they don't lose their position. They don't want to be held accountable, the legislators, which is why they give away their position and they delegate some of their powers away to other branches and other bureaucracies, which is unconstitutional, by the way. So he goes on next to state, and I quote, and he explains this phenomena. He says, but every amendment of the Constitution, if once established, would be a single proposition and might be brought forward singly. There would then be no necessity for management or compromise in relation to any other point, no giving nor taking. The will of the requisite number would at once bring the matter to a decisive issue. And consequently, whenever 9 or rather 10 of the states were united in the desire of a particular amendment, that amendment must infallibly take place, end quote. So then he kind of goes on to explain, because some of the dissenters are making the argument that the federal government will be able to change the Constitution at will. And he goes on to kind of explain the whole program and how it works. Hamilton makes a point to differentiate that the approval and original establishment of the Constitution requires the participation of all states that fall under its jurisdiction, but an amendment, rather, requires much less of that. Hamilton asserts, and I quote, there can therefore be no comparison between the facility of effecting an amendment and that of establishing in the first instance a complete Constitution. Once again, all states that fall under the Constitution have to ratify it at some point, whereas with amendments, it only requires 3/4 of the legislative branches of the state governments to reach approval. So he states next, and I quote, in opposition to the probability of subsequent amendments, it has been urged that the persons delegated to the administration of the national government will always be disinclined to yield up any portion of the authority of which they were once possessed. For my own part, I acknowledge a thorough conviction that any amendments which may, upon mature consideration, be thought useful will be applicable to the organization of the government, not to the mass of the powers. And on this account alone, I think there is no weight in the observation just stated. I also think there is little weight in it on another account. The intrinsic difficulty of governing 13 states at any rate, independent of calculations upon an ordinary degree of public spirit and integrity, will, in my opinion, constantly impose on the national rulers the necessity of the spirit of accommodation to the reasonable expectations of their constituents, end quote. So you have the dissenters coming out with this opinion that the administration of the national government will just take up, they'll always be, and this is kind of weird, the opposition saying that they will always be disinclined to yield up any portion of the authority of which they were once possessed, which is kind of weird because, as we've seen over time, the government has continued to actually gain more power, and Alexander Hamilton says the same thing. What the worry here was is we'd have a federal head that wasn't acting properly and doing their job. They'd be disinclined to take up more power, which is kind of weird. And he was saying, no, it's not going to happen. They'll just continue to do their job because the state governments are really the ones that tell the federal government how to work. The senators were elected by the state legislative authority. And then if you wanted to get any type of amendment passed, you had to go through the state legislatures, right? So the people, the state governments really ran the federal government, which is why it's called federalism. It's not the same way as it works in other countries where there's a national government and it works from the top down. In this country, it's supposed to work from the bottom up. It's supposed to work as the regular citizen up to the state government, and the state government kind of runs the federal government. That's usually the way it's supposed to work. Now, is it currently working under that same establishment and that same organizational structure. I'm not really exactly sure, but it's definitely not a national government. There should be sovereignty in the individual and in the state. So Hamilton, he continues with a provision. He states, and I quote, "On the application of the legislatures of two-thirds of the states, which at present amount to 9, to call a convention for proposing amendments which shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of the Constitution when ratified by the legislatures of three-fourths of the states or by conventions in three-fourths thereof," end quote. This is pretty interesting. So he says, yeah, once again, this is a top-down governing structure, which we've really never seen before. Nowadays, it works for most states. And at that current time, it was a top-down structure where, you know, the king or the president or whoever it was, the federal government would run everything. Here he's saying, if we want to have a call a convention to propose some amendments, you have to start it from the bottom up. You have to start at the state government level. You have to get two-thirds of the states to agree, which is about, it's 9 at the time. And then they have this constitutional convention talking about amendments. And then that has to be validated and ratified by three-fourths of the states, the state governments, which is very interesting. It's just not what people think it is. And because of that, that would give more power to the state governments, but we've kind of overhauled the former system, and we validated that the federal government has way more power than constitutionally intended. In terms of, if you just look at Obamacare alone, there's just no power in the federal government and the Constitution saying that they have the right to pretty much confiscate wealth from one person and use it to pay for somebody else's health care. But I'm going to go on here. He states next, and I quote, "The words of this article are peremptory. The Congress shall call a convention. Nothing in this particular is left to the discretion of that body. And of consequence, all the declamation about the disinclination to a change vanishes in air. Nor, however difficult it may be supposed to unite two-thirds or three-fourths of the state legislatures in amendments which may affect local interests, can there be any room to apprehend any such difficulty in a union on points which are merely relative to the general liberty or security of the people. We may safely rely on the disposition of the state legislatures to erect barriers against the encroachments of the national authority," end quote. So maybe it was before that these people were stating that they were afraid of the federal government passing and proposing more and more amendments to the Constitution. And what he said is, well, you have the state governments to protect against that. I think that's what he was trying to refer to, because it was kind of confusing at first. So yeah, you have this disinclination of change vanishes from the federal government. The federal government is not going to be able to sit there and pass amendment after amendment, because they have to go through the state legislative authority. That's the safeguard. That's the balance of powers. When we talk about balance of powers, everyone likes to talk about the federal government and the three branches. And me personally, I kind of like to include the fourth branch, being the media, a little bit. But in terms of federal government, it's always, you got the legislative, you got the executive, you got the judiciary, where really what it is, you have that. And then you also have the state government. That's a complete other power that stops a lot of federal encroachments, which he states here. And that's why it gives more sense of security to the individual and to the state governments. Hamilton, he expresses the amendments will be for organizational purposes and believes amendments do not serve a beneficial purpose to yield more authority and power. This is very interesting. He claims, and I quote, "For my own part, I acknowledge a thorough conviction that any amendment which may, upon mature consideration, be though useful or thought useful, will be applicable to the organization of the government, not the mass of its powers." I mean, this is monumental, this quote that he said. He said, pretty much, I think that the federal government, what is laid out, the powers that are laid out in the federal government are enough. That's all they need. There is no amendment for more power to expand the power of the federal government. The only amendment that's applicable to the Constitution is in terms of the organization of the government, so the government can already do what its laid out powers are in a more efficient manner, more effective manner. And this is a monumental quote, especially from the guy that wanted the energetic, powerful government, coming from Alexander Hamilton. That's probably actually the quote of this paper. That may be the quote of the Federalist Papers, and I almost missed it here. Hamilton, he concludes these papers by exalting the proposed plan. He says, and I quote, "A nation without a national government is, in my view, an awful spectacle. The establishment of a constitution in time of profound peace, by the voluntary consent of the whole people, is a prodigy, to the completion of which I look forward with trembling anxiety. End quote. So he's like, this is amazing. Profound peace we're going to find. When he means profound peace, he means between different groups, between factional violence in the individual states. And this is going to be voluntary by the consent of the whole people. And this is the greatest governing document of all time. I highly suggest, if you haven't, you know, checked this out. There's also the Constitutional Debates. I have that book somewhere around here as well. I'm reading this right now. I think this is at the Anti-Federalist and the Constitutional Convention Debates. You can actually get this on Audible. I know people don't like Amazon, but Amazon Audible, if you sign up for a subscription with them, it's like $15 a month. I know it's a little pricey, but they'll give you one free token to buy specific specialized books. And then there's a bunch that are actually free. So right now I'm going through that. I'm going through Thomas Sowell. Has a bunch of free books on there. Some really good material. Some good stuff. And you can understand where they were coming from and the different constitutional debates they had at the convention. Different compromises. There was the New Jersey Compromise. The Massachusetts Compromise. But definitely some cool stuff to check out. So he ends these papers with a very powerful statement. And this is the very last... is the last paragraph. He states, and I quote, "These judicious reflections contain a lesson of moderation to all the sincere lovers of the Union, and ought to put them upon their guard against hazarding anarchy, civil war, or perpetual alienation of the states from each other, and perhaps the military despotism of a victorious demagoguery, in the pursuit of what they are not likely to obtain, but from time and experience. It may be in me a defect of political fortitude, but I acknowledge that I cannot entertain an equal tranquility with those who affect to treat the dangers of a longer continuance in our present situation as imagery or imaginary. A nation without a national government is, in my view, an awful spectacle. The establishment of the Constitution in time of profound peace by the voluntary consent of a whole people is a prodigy to the completion of which I look forward with trembling anxiety. I can reconcile it to no rules of prudence to let go the hold we now have is so arduous as enterprise upon 7 out of the 13 states, and after having passed over so considerable a part of the ground to recommence the course, I dread the more the consequences of new attempts, because I know that powerful individuals in this and other states are enemies to the general national government in every possible shape." End quote. So at this time, I guess when he wrote this, this paper came out after the ratification of the Constitution. But I guess him and Madison were getting together and they were writing these papers as they were going through the Constitutional Convention debates. And he said, at this time, we only have 7 out of the 13 states that want to ratify this. And I'm kind of nervous. I'm trembling with anxiety about it because I know there's a lot of powerful people that are in other states that don't want a national government. And he goes, "Me personally, you can call me biased, but I love this. It may be my own personal defect of political fortitude," as he called it. But he said he cannot entertain any idea of equal tranquility between the states and protection, security, additionally, in the United States. Like, this is how, I mean, we started the country with the Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation, but he says this is like a huge step for our society here. And also, I think they understood in the scope of things, because a lot of, especially Madison and Hamilton were very smart guys, they understood how big of a step this was for mankind. If you looked all around the world at this time, federalism, the idea of a self-government has just never been done successfully. It's never really been done truly either as well. And they realized what they were doing because they were big-time studiers of philosophy, and they understood some of this stuff. So I definitely think this is one of the best documents to read, other than obviously the exact Constitution itself. But this document helps lay out and helps you understand what the scope of the federal government, what the purpose of the federal government was, as well as what the main intentions were to establish from some of these framers of the Constitution. So that'll conclude the Federalist Papers. That'll conclude the whole thing. Going to continue to do current events. I greatly appreciate everybody taking this journey with me. It's been a good 8 months doing this. Stress. I mean, it was a lot of work to do. I appreciate everyone that tunes in and gives it the time of day anybody that drops the mic, let people know about the podcast. You let people just know about this series in general because it's been a long series. If they ever want to learn anything, to just straight up download each individual podcast. I'm going to keep everything up. I don't think they take it down. Maybe over time they might. But I'm going to have it all saved onto a hard drive as well, just in case if anything like that were to happen. But I greatly appreciate it, folks. I will see you all next time. Wednesday night, we're going to have the Federalist, or rather, we're going to have the current events episode. And then over the weekend, we're going to continue with the weekend special as well. And maybe if I continue to read, maybe I'll do a special episode here and there about, you know, let's say maybe a Communist Manifesto or Common Sense by Thomas Paine, something like that, as I continue my studies and my reading. So I greatly appreciate you folks tuning in for this entire series, and we're going to continue doing it. So thank you, and I will see you folks next time.